أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. ألم تر إلى الذي حاج إبراهيم في ربه أن آتاه الله الملك إذ قال إبراهيم ربي الذي يحيي ويميت قال أنا أحيي وأميت قال إبراهيم فإن الله يأتي بالشمس من المشرق فأتي بها من المغرب فبهت الذي كفر والله لا يهدي القوم الظالمين. رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي. فالحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على رسول الله وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. ثم أما بعد. Once again everyone, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. My intention today is try to reach ayah number 260. We're at 258. Today is some very heavy ayah to cover. And some very interesting accounts in the Quran, historical accounts. These three are made up of three, one ayah each references to historical events. The first of them I started talking about to you before. I'll translate the entire ayah briefly so that everybody here has an idea of what we're talking about. أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَى الَّذِي حَاجَ إِبْرَاهِيمَ فِي رَبِّهِ. Didn't you ponder over the one who argued against Ibrahim alayhi salam in the matter of his master, أَنْ أَتَاهُ اللَّهُ الْمُلْكُ, on account of the fact that Allah had given him kingdom. إِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّيَ الَّذِي يُحْيِي وَيُمِيتُ. When Ibrahim alayhi salam said to him, my master is the one that gives life and gives death. قَالَ أَنَا أُحْيِي وَأُمِيتُ. He said, I, in fact, I'm the one who gives life and I give death. قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْتِي بِالشَّمْسِ مِنَ الْمَشْرِقِ فَأْتِ بِهَا مِنَ الْمَغْرِبِ. Ibrahim then said that it is certainly Allah that brings the sun out from the east, so bring it out from the west. فَبُهِتَ الَّذِي كَفَرْ. Then the one who had disbelieved was stumped, was overrun in argument. وَاللَّهُ لَا يَهْدِ الْقَوْمَ الظَّالِمِينَ. And Allah, in fact, does not guide wrongdoing nations. That's the gist of the ayah. In this ayah, like we said before, there's a reference to a historical confrontation between Ibrahim alayhi salam and someone who's been given kingdom. Our historians call him Namrud, or the biblical term, even though there's no direct reference to it, is Nimrod. This is similar to the account that Musa alayhi salam faced with Fir'aun. So there's two confrontations with a ruler in the Quran. This is one of them, and the detailed one, of course, is Musa and Fir'aun. The thing that I highlighted some things about an atahu Allahul mulk in the last session, but what I want to talk about today, start with today, is just the phrase that, you know, he argued with Ibrahim alayhi salam about his master solely on the fact that, or solely based on the idea that Allah had given him kingdom. This an atahu Allahul mulk can also be used as a kind of ta'ajjub, uslubu ta'ajjub, like, you know, Ibn Ashur rahimahullah in a tahrir wa tanbih says, وَالدَّاعِيُ لِهَاتِهِ الْإِسْتِعَارَةَ التَّهَكُّمْ. This is actually Allah Azza wa Jal criticizing him that I've given you so much and you turn back and defy me. Like, that's the sentiment of it. You know, when you do something more for someone, you expect them to be more grateful. And Allah has given him kingdom. He's given him more than most people. And yet he turns around and defies Allah and speaks of himself as he's God. فَوَضَعَ الْكُفْرَ مَوْضِعَ الشُّكْرِ. He ended up doing disbelief where the rightful thing for him to do, more than anyone else, should have been that he should have been more grateful. The second interesting thing here is where does this get situated in the life of Ibrahim alayhi salam? What we get in the Quran is a lot of like sporadic sprinkles, pieces of the life of Ibrahim alayhi salam, and we don't have a complete thorough picture. We have bits and pieces of his life, and the way the Quran tells stories, just like it does in Baqarah, what the Quran does is it'll tell you a part of history that has to do with the lessons being taught. So history is actually never the point itself. That's not the point. The Quran doesn't make reference to history to teach you about history necessarily. That may come along the way as an added benefit. So the Quran is not a history book. But the Quran is actually, each surah presents a kind of, you can say, a thesis, a purpose, an agenda. And to make the point of that thesis, whatever story reference is necessary, Allah will use. This is why stories are not even in chronological order in the Quran. They are whatever reference is necessary to make the point, right? And so, the thing we're going to have to learn, not only is this story being referenced, but why is this story being talked about? Like, along these lines I just shared with you recently, when Allah talked about fighting in the path of Allah, and the Muslims were being mentally prepared to take on a much larger army of Quraysh, well, this is a good time to bring up the story of Dawud, Talut, and Jalut. Because those are the kinds of things you're going to have to keep in mind and keep your hearts and minds fresh as you face your enemy. Right? So the story was serving that larger purpose. Now here's the other interesting thing. Like for those of you that are, you know, you have to, some of you are in school, some of you are in college, you're writing a paper and you have to present case studies or examples to make a point. Example 1, 2, 3, 4. That's kind of how stories work in the Quran. Examples are being presented. They're not in chronological order, and they're not, only details that are mentioned are the ones that have to do with your point. And other details aren't necessary. This is important to note because then every detail that is mentioned is strategic. So the problem, if we don't understand this, is like you're studying the surah, like Surah Yusuf, the story of Joseph, right? And there's lots we don't know. We don't know where Yusuf lived. We don't know where this well was. We don't know his brothers' names. Not any of them. There's no mention of any of the names of his brothers. His mom is never talked about. The minister's wife that tried to seduce him, we don't know her name. She's just called Imra'at al-Aziz, the wife of the minister. That's all she's called. The minister, we don't know his name. He's just called al-Aziz. The king, we don't know his name. He's just called the king. There's so many details missing. Actually, the only two people mentioned by name are, actually, his father's not even mentioned by name. He's just called his dad. Later on, other places in the Quran, we learn who he is, Yaqub alayhi salam, but he's not mentioned by name in the surah. And so what our mufassirun do when we study the surah, right, we're like, well, let me fill you in on all the things Allah didn't tell you. This is her name is Zulaykha, this is Yaqub, here are the 11 brothers, you know, and here are their names, and the youngest one's name is Binyamin, and blah, 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 like all these details, right? Which is all interesting information, but the real question to be asked is, why didn't Allah tell us? Why did Allah skip this? Why do we have to go to outside sources to get that answer? Why wasn't it there? What that teaches, at least from my point of view, I consider this a fundamental in the study of the Qur'an. The stories of the Qur'an have to be studied not from the point of view of what's missing, but rather strategically, why did Allah choose to tell me this and not other things? Perhaps that other information is not as necessary for my guidance or for the lesson that Allah is intending to teach than what He did choose to share. You know, so that's a really important consideration. Now here we have, what's the name of this king? Quran is making it irrelevant. What Quran is making relevant about him is two things. الَّذِي حَاجَّ إِبْرَاهِيمَ فِي رَبِّهِ and الَّذِي كَفَرْ. His two descriptions in the Quran are the one who debated with Ibrahim alayhi salam about his God, about his master. And the two that he disbelieved. And those two things are the two descriptions of the same guy. What does that tell you? The ones who debate about God in an obnoxious way, that is in fact an act of kufr. That is alladhi kafar. Those two things are interchangeable. That's what the ayah has done. Now the other interesting thing here is how Ibrahim speaks, alayhi salam. Ibrahim alayhi salam, and Allah wanted to highlight not the entire debate, but He wanted to highlight one part of this debate. Which part? That's what's captured in the word is. أَلَمْ تَرَى إِلَى الَّذِي حَاجَّ إِبْرَاهِيمَ فِي رَبِّهِ أَنْ أَتَاهُ اللَّهُ الْمُلْكِ إِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّيَ الَّذِي يُحْيِي وَيُمِيتُ. At the moment, as part of this debate, when Ibrahim alayhi salam said, my master is the one that gives life and gives death. My master controls life and my master controls death. Now you all know that Ibrahim alayhi salam as a young man challenged idols. You probably know that. And when he did challenge idols, people made fun of him, didn't take him seriously. His dad pretty much expelled him. And he wanted to, he was so bothered by the asnam that, as many of you are probably familiar, when they were out in a festival doing their thing, he went and wrecked all the idols. He destroyed all of them. Judha then is the word used in the Quran, which is basically, in Urdu you would say, unka kachumar bana diya. Like he smashed them to bits. He smashed the idols to bits. And he left only the big one. And left the whatever hammer, axe, whatever it was, left it with him. And then when they came, they said, you know, somebody was talking trash about our gods. Some young kid, yuqalu lahu Ibrahim. I think that he's called, I've heard Ibrahim being used for him. Like it's said in such a way like, nobody knows who this kid is. And we may have heard his name. I think it's Ibrahim. So they go after him and he says, ask the big one. And they were really upset about this.
You know, so they decided, حَرِّقُوا وَانْصُرُوا آلِهَتَكُمْ. Burn him alive. And aid your gods. That's in the Quran. So he was thrown into a fire. And many of you might know, when the fire he was thrown into, Allah commanded the fire, يَا نَارُ كُونِي بَرْدًا وَسَلَامًا عَلَى إِبْرَاهِيمُ. Become cold. And a source of peace on Ibrahim alayhi salam. So the fire didn't burn him. Now anybody else being thrown into a massive fire, obviously that is death. And he's thrown into this fire, not as an old man, but as a young man. And he now knows firsthand Allah controls what? Life and death. So when he's speaking right now with this king, it's not like he's talking in theory, or he just has this iman in the unseen. He's actually experienced Allah controlling life and death right in front of him. He's been inside a fire that refused to burn. As a matter of fact, if you look at the life of Ibrahim alayhi salam, one of the most salient lessons, very, very powerful lessons that keeps recurring in his life is actually Allah's power to preserve life and Allah's control over death. So for instance, he has to leave his family in the middle of a desert. And that is the equivalent of them what? Dying. Then he's given a dream that he has to slaughter his child, which is now, again, your child being put to death. Over and over again, you find in his story that he has to face the challenge of Allah Azza wa Jal deciding who gets to live and who gets to die. That, and how Allah decides to do that. That's his life experience. So when he says, and we don't know at which point in his career he said this, but clearly it's not early in his career. It's not when he's a child, because there was no king in that village. It was just the people. But now he's in trouble somewhere else. And this king has now called him to account. And he says, my master is the one that gives life and gives death. رَبِّي أَلَّذِي يُحْيِي وَيُمِيتِ. And the king responds, أَنَا أُحْيِي وَأُمِيتِ. In fact, I give life and death. You mean me? So one of the ways to interpret that is, oh, you mean me. This is an important consideration. When you say master, رَبِّ, which some translate as Lord. Lord, I feel, is a bit distant of a word, and nowadays when people use the word Lord, they think of things that have to do with rings, or people that shall not be named, etc. So, or people think of a biblical reference to Lord, right? Or if you're from the Indian Pakistani subcontinent, you might think of like colonizers, Lord Baton and Lord other white guy that took over our land and stole our jewelry, etc. Like that, you know. So the word Lord has these other connotations in English literature, either biblical or mythical or colonial, etc. But the word master is actually closer to the sense of the word Rabb, is someone who has a slave. He's the absolute authority over someone. And so I prefer the term master over Lord. Also probably because when I was younger and I used to hear khutbas in very heavy accents, people used to say, the Lord. And then I was like, I don't know what that is. But anyway, Ibrahim alayhi salam said, my master is the one that gives life and death. Now when he says master, did he spell out who he is? He didn't say Allah. He just said, my master. Before I tell you what happens here, I'll tell you another place in the Quran. You probably are familiar with the story of Musa alayhi salam and the magicians, right? And so when Musa alayhi salam threw the staff, all the magicians, their ropes and rods were there, and they looked to people, you know, that they were like snakes, but when he threw his staff, it swallowed everything they came up with. All the ropes and rods disappeared in one shot. And as soon as that happened, the magicians, the sorcerers, they fell into sajda. There's someone right there that you're tipping over, Sister Man. Right there. He almost died. Okay. So I'll move over for you. How about that? You happier? Okay. So what happens is so what was I saying something about Islam? The staff. Yes, the staff. Thank you. So these magicians, the sorcerers, they fall into sajda, and Fir'aun is confused, like, what just happened? Is this part of the rehearsal, or is this like you're getting ready for round two? What's going on here? So they get up from sajda and they say, Amanna بِرَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. We have now come to believe in the master of all nations. And the Pharaoh is still standing there. Yeah, I know. Right here. So they have to clarify. And then they say, رَبِّ مُوسَى وَهَارُونَ. As if in parentheses it says, the master of Musa and Harun. You idiot. Not you. Like it had to be spelled out. Because the word رَبِّ Have there been people who have used the word Rabb falsely for themselves? They have. Even the Pharaoh said, أَنَا رَبُّكُمُ الْأَعْلَى. So when you say, I believe in the Master, I believe in the Rabb, or my Rabb gives life and death, this king arrogantly says, you mean me, right? And a lot of historians take the account of, this is interpreted in two ways. Like he had people believe that he was a god. Because you know, life and death is an unseen thing. And so he said, actually, yes, I have these mystical powers, I do control life and death. And others say, no, actually what he did was, he brought two prisoners out of prison, and they were both supposed to be executed, but he executed one of them and let the other one go. And he says, see, I give life and I give death. So you're talking about me, right? This is أَنَا أُحْيِي وَأُمِيتُ. Now obviously, when Ibrahim alayhi salam says, my master gives life and my master gives death, he's talking about every tree, every bird. He's talking about, you know, every living creature. He's talking about the angels. He's talking about all of humanity. He's talking about the seen world and the unseen world. Wherever life exists, it exists because of Allah. And anybody with half a sense would know that that's what he's referring to. And the king that he's debating with well knows that that's what he's referring to also. But he gave an obnoxious and absurd response. And this is something that we have to understand about the word buhtan. The Arabic word buhtan. Before we even get to the word buhit alladhi kafar, you have to understand the word buhtan in Arabic. But buhtan means an ugly lie. But it's more than that. Actually, it means something so ridiculous that you hear that you get paralyzed and you don't know what to say in response. You know, a great genius of someone who's debating you is not to give you an intelligent answer, but actually to give you an answer so utterly stupid that you don't know what to do now. Like, you don't even know where to begin. It's actually a pretty ingenious thing to do. And we now are like, yeah, I know, I've been watching that on TV quite a bit nowadays. That's what's called a buhtan. Something so absurd, something so outrageous, that leaves you stunned. And that's what this guy has done. أَنَا أُحْيِي وَأُمِيتُ. Now Ibrahim alayhi salam, where do I begin with this guy? I'm talking about the creation of the skies and the earth, life itself, Adam alayhi salam, the offspring. Oh, no, this guy, no. There's no, you can't even begin with people like that. These people clearly, when they give you such an absurd response, there are two reasons for which they do it. And more likely it's the second reason, but I'll give you both reasons. One reason is they really don't possess the intellect. Okay, that's rarely the case. They do possess the intellect. The second reason is by doing this, they have stirred up a crowd and they have turned this argument into an irrational, emotional, mob kind of an argument where everybody's like, yeah! And when you create that scene, logic, reason, rational argument is out the window. Now you can present your argument, try to present it as rationally as you want. Nobody has to hear anything you have to say. This is done even nowadays. Nowadays you might have, for example, on television, some expert, some academic, right, who has a certain point of view. Is a political scientist, sociologist, psychologist, whoever. That's the expert who knows his stuff. He's been studying this thing for 30 years or whatever. And on the other side, you have the host of the show, who is loud, obnoxious, cuts you off, and says the most ridiculous things. And so the professor guy is like, well, you know, according to the research, you know. And this guy's like, well, we all know that science is for idiots. And I disagree. We're going to cut to break. I know you don't have an answer for that one. The one who's intelligent actually seems like they get stumped, isn't it? So, the genius of Ibrahim alayhi salam is, when he faces this kind of ridiculous question, he knows how to respond, not to address, no, actually, you're wrong, the answer you gave is wrong, and let me correct you, because he knows there's no point correcting some people. I'm just going to switch over to something that's so blatant and so much easier, because this was any reasonable person would have heard the argument, Allah gives life and my master gives life and death, and would have gotten it. But since he's able to twist that into something ridiculous anyway, let me give him something else that is going to be harder to twist, harder to mold. So what does Ibrahim alayhi salam do? Ibrahim alayhi salam says, فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْتِي بِالشَّمْسِ مِنَ الْمَشْرِقِ فَأْتِ بِهَا مِنَ الْمَغْرِبِ. Allah, in fact, He brings the sun out from the east. Why don't you bring it from the west then? No life and death. I mean, since you control. Why don't we, okay, you know what? You win that one. Have it. How about the sun? And this time he didn't say my master, you notice? He didn't say my master brings the sun from the east, bring it from the west. He said, Allah brings it from the east. You bring it from the west. Because the first time he said, Rabb, what could he have construed it as? Well, obviously you're talking about me. Watch this. Now when he says Allah, I ain't talking about you. And this is way above your pay grade. فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ يَأْتِي بِشَمْسِ مِنَ الْمَشْرِقِ فَأْتِي بِهَا مِنَ الْمَغْرِبِ It's a concise, powerful response. And what I want to share with you here also is something about life. You guys know, right, that in the Quran, life and being awake are compared to each other, and death and sleeping are compared to each other? Okay, you also know that a few ayats before this was Ayatul Kursi. In Ayatul Kursi, the introduction to Allah was, Allahu la ilaha illa huwa al-hayyu al-qayyum la ta'khudhuhu sinatun wa la nawm. And by the way, la ta'khudhuhu sinatun wa la nawm, drowsiness doesn't get a hold of him, sleep never gets a hold of him, is actually describing how he is alive like no one else. Like he is uniquely the source of life. Because drowsiness and sleep are similar to what? Death. Now, if you notice the argument that Ibrahim alayhi salam began with, it seems to be an argument directly from the opening of Ayatul Kursi. Allahu la ilaha illa huwa al-hayyul qayyum, la ta'khudhuhu sinatun wa la nawm. And inspired by that he says, Rabbi alladhi yuhyi wa yumeet. When that argument was misused, what's the next argument that, he used? Did he use an argument about life and death? No. He used the argument, Allah controls the sun, isn't it? Go to Ayatul Kursi, what's the second part after that? لَهُ مَا فِي السَّمَوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ He owns the whatever's in the skies and whatever's in the earth. He resorted right immediately to the next line of argument. There's actually a consistency in what we've been taught as a universal teaching about Allah, and how Ibrahim alayhi salam actually embodied the teachings of Ayatul Kursi, at least the introductory part of it, in the way he presented his argument. Allah brings the sun from the east, why don't you bring it from the west? And now, this piece, فَبُهِتَ الَّذِي كَفَرَ Really cool. Now, the one who disbelieved has been stumped. But the word used for him being stumped, يعني عجزة عن الجواب. He was incapable of coming up with a witty, quick response. He felt paralyzed. Is actually the same word from which you get the word buhtan. Buhita allazi kafar is the same origin of the word buhtan. And buhtan is what he had done when he said, Ana uhyi wa umeet. He was trying to stump Ibrahim alayhi salam, and Allah says, that backfired, he's the one that got stumped with the very, hoping the very result he was hoping for Ibrahim alayhi salam falls upon him. Bima'na a'jazahu an al-jawab fa فَعَجَزْ أَوْ فَاجَأَهُ بِمَا لَمْ يَعْرِفْ بِمَا لَمْ يَعْرِفْ دَفْعُهُ Like actually, he did دَفْعَهُ He didn't know how to respond to this, and he caught him from an angle that he didn't even think of. And so now, what we're learning is that we have to, there are different kinds of discourse in Islam. There's مَوْعِظَ حَسَنَة There's, common advice. Be good, be kind to parents, take care of your prayers, be forgiving, be patient, be grateful, etc., etc. This is kind advice. People that are eager to learn advice, you give them good advice. You don't yell and scream at them. You're soft with them. Allah Quran will call that al-maw'izatil hasana. Then there are people that they don't just need simple advice, they have difficult questions. They want to understand the wisdom behind why should we believe. They want to look at the deeper reality of things and be convinced. So just giving them a spiritual sermon, which is good in and of itself, isn't enough for them. Well, for those people, you have to call them with wisdom. اُدْعُوا إِلَى سَبِيلِ رَبِّكَ بِالْحِكْمَةِ وَالْمَوْعِظَةِ الْحَسَنَةِ But then there are some people who just want to argue for the sake of arguing. There are some people that aren't interested in learning, and they're not interested in good advice, they just love arguing. And you have to have the sense to identify those kinds of people, and then you have to do jidal with them, وَجَادِلْهُمْ بِالَّتِي هِيَ أَحْسَنَ You argue with them, debate with them in a way that is better. Meaning whatever level they're playing at, find a better way to get at them. And also means in a way that is more beautiful. In other words, if they turn ugly, you don't turn ugly. If they lose their cool, you don't lose your cool. You keep your calm.
فَبُهِتَ الَّذِي كَفَرْ وَاللَّهُ لَا يَهْدِي الْقَوْمَ الظَّالِمِينَ.
And Allah, in fact, He doesn't guide wrongdoing nations. What does that mean that at the end? That's a very important conclusion to this ayah.
وَاللَّهُ لَا يَهْدِي الْقَوْمَ الظَّالِمِينَ.
It actually suggests that people that are just interested in arguing, these are people that have made up their mind that they're not interested in using the gift Allah gave them of reason. Especially not, because you know, people that are argumentative for the sake of argumentation, that's actually, it's a very thin mask for their pride. Right? Because defeating somebody in argument is like winning a match. Or defeating somebody in sport. It becomes a sport to them. And they find stumping someone, humiliating someone, leaving someone, you know, stunned and incapable of responding, they get a high off of that stuff. There are some people who actually really enjoy annoying you, or really enjoy insulting you, or really enjoy making you feel stupid, or making you feel worthless. And all of those things are rooted in one's own insecurities. They just want, you know, kind of an enhancement of themselves, a self-aggrandization. Allah Azza wa Jalla is not saying Allah doesn't guide people who ask questions. Allah Azza wa Jalla is saying when people have made up their mind to be arrogant and be this way and be obnoxious this way deliberately, then there's no reason the gift of guidance should be open to them. Wallahu la yahdi al-qawm al-zalimin. This is not Allah saying Allah randomly decided some people shouldn't be guided. The Quran's formula is actually people make up their mind. They don't want to accept the guidance. They want to be defiant, they want to be arrogant about it, they want to be obnoxious and unreasonable about it. Basically then Allah says, fine, have it your way. That's Wallahu la yahdi al-qawm al-zalimin. The next ayah begins with yet another story, and this story is actually, I won't give you the long biblical citation, I will say that there are a few places this could be a reference to. Amin Ahsan Islahi and some other classical scholars, and even some contemporary academics hold the view that this story that we're about to read now is a passing reference to the story of Ezekiel in the Bible. And it's a very interesting story. This is at a time when the Israelites were going through a lot of decline, and the city of Jerusalem was actually completely abandoned. So the inhabitants of Jerusalem, half the population was slaughtered, and the other half were taken as slaves. And so the city was completely abandoned. And some biblical accounts say no two bricks remained intact in the city of Jerusalem. Okay? And this deterioration lasted a very long time. This abandonment of the city of Jerusalem remained for a very, very long time. Until the time of this prophet, Ezekiel, who's passing by this town, this what used to be the capital of faith. This used to be the sacred city. It's like imagining that the Haram has been abandoned and destroyed, you know? So Allah describes, أَوْكَالَّذِي مَرَّ عَلَىٰ قَرْيَةٍ, or like the one who passed by a town. Or like the one who passed by a town. And I'll come back to the word like in when I explain. Yeah. Way before Isa alayhi salam. Yeah. Some say this is a Jewish, a Christian story, but that doesn't hold true. This is a Jewish account. Okay. So, and Ezekiel is one of the biblical prophets, so this is well before Isa alayhi salam. Anyway, so, أَوْكَالَّذِي مَرَّ عَلَىٰ قَرْيَةٍ. And by the way, just so the confusion isn't there, the destruction of Jerusalem after Jesus, after Isa alayhi salam, came at the hands of the Romans. And the one before, the early destruction, was at the hand of the Assyrians and the Babylonians, the Iraqis. Okay? So this is the previous destruction of Jerusalem, because it happened twice. And Quran makes reference to the two rises of the nation too. And the two destructions also in Surah Al-Isra. Okay? Surah number 17. So, أَوْ كَالَّذِي مَرَّ عَلَىٰ قَرْيَةٍ, or like the one who passed by a town, وَهِيَ خَاوِيَةٌ عَلَىٰ عُرُوشِهَا, and it was turned over on its rooftops. The town, it sounds strange. It was turned over on its rooftops. I'll explain what that means. But before I do that, we'll keep on reading. قَالَ أَنَّا يُحْيِي هَذِهِ اللَّهُ بَعْدَ مَوْتِهَا. He said, how on earth, how in the world, is Allah going to bring this back to life after it has completely died? This meaning the city. فَأَمَاتَهُ اللَّهُ مِئَةَ عَامٍ ثُمَّ بَعَثَ. So Allah gave him death for the period of 100 years and then raised him up again. قَالَ كَمْ لَبِثْ. He said to him, how long were you there? How long did you remain there? قَالَ لَبِثْتُ يَوْمًا أَوْ بَعْضَ يَوْمٍ. He said, I must have been here a day, maybe part of a day. Because death is similar to what? Sleep. When you fall asleep, you lose track of time. If you've been sleeping for 24 hours, right? Or 25 hours, you slept at 10 a.m., and you woke up at 11 a.m. the next day, you'd be like, wow, that was a really good hour. You know, you wouldn't have track of time. If you're knocked out, you're knocked out, you know. So, وَهِيَ خَاوِيَةٌ عَلَىٰ قَالَ أَنَّا يُحْيِي هَذِهِ اللَّهُ بَعْدَ مَوْتِهَا فَأَمَاتَهُ اللَّهُ مِئَةَ عَامٍ ثُمَّ بَعَثَ. Then he raised him up again, said, how long were you here? He said, I was here a day, you know, لَبِثْتُ يَوْمًا وَبَعْضَ يَوْمٍ. قَالَ بَلْ لَبِثْتَ مِئَةَ عَامٍ. No, actually, you've been here for 100 years. فَانْظُرْ إِلَىٰ طَعَامِكَ وَشَرَابِكَ لَمْ يَتَسَنَّ. Take a look at your food. Look at your drink and your food. It hasn't aged at all. The effect of aging hasn't impacted your food whatsoever. It's still fresh. When you look at the food that's fresh, you're like, that's not no 100 years. Because the food is exactly fresh. Right? And then he says, فَانْظُرْ إِلَىٰ حِمَارِكَ. Also take a look at your mule. Not mule, donkey. Your gada. Take a look at your donkey. وَلِنَجْعَلَكَ آيَةً لِلنَّاسِ. I'm not explaining right now, I'm just translating. And all of this so that we may turn you into a sign for the people. وَانْظُرْ إِلَى الْعِظَامِ كَيْفَ نُنْشِزُهَا ثُمَّ نَكْسُوهَا لَحْمًا. Another qira'a, كَيْفَ نُنْشِرُهَا بِالرَّاءِ ثُمَّ نَكْسُوهَا لَحْمًا. Then take a look at the bones. How we cause them to rise. To jump up. The bones would jump up. And how we dress those bones with flesh. ثُمَّ نَكْسُوهَا لَحْمًا. فَلَمَّا تَبَيَّنَ لَهُ. When all of this became abundantly clear to him, قَالَ أَعْلَمُ أَنَّ اللَّهَ عَلَىٰ كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٍ. He said, I know well that Allah is capable to do anything. Allah is capable over all things. That's the basic idea of the... By the way, this is the story of Ezekiel once again. Most Muslim scholars believe this is 587 BCE. So 587 roughly. And this is Ezra of Jeremiah. In the book of Jeremiah, this is actually mentioned. Anyway, so now, and there are other opinions on it too, but that's, regardless, who it refers to is less important. Why? Because Allah didn't mention it explicitly for a reason. We go back to that principle, right? So the goal is to understand what is it that Allah is making reference to. What we know is there are multiple accounts in the Bible, or in the Hebrew traditions, of somebody dying. Some say 66 years, others say 30 years, there's different stories. And in one of them, he wakes up and he goes back to town and he doesn't recognize the town. And it's got some parallels to the story, but not exactly. You know, and the drink was actually the fruit, the dripping olives. And they were still dripping. And so he goes back to town and he can't find anybody there. And then he finds an old man and says, where's so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so? And they're like, they all died a long time ago. What are you talking about? And he's like, no, they couldn't have died. I just picked these fruits and they're still wet. He goes, that hasn't even come in season yet. And look at this field. And then, so he looked at that and then he realized Allah has put him away for that many. And that story is actually 66 years. But anyway, the point here, let's go back to the point. The first interesting thing here is ka. Or like the one who passed by a town. When you say like, then you're giving an example. Like this, or like that, or like that. But the cool thing is, there was no example before this. Allah said, didn't you look at Ibrahim? When he argued, he didn't say, take the example of Ibrahim. What are we learning? We're actually learning every time Allah gives a story, He's actually giving an example. Let me explain what that means. That's an important thing for you to understand. Every time Allah tells a story, He's actually giving an example. It may have happened historically, of course. But that's not why it's being told. It's being told necessarily to give you an example of a lesson. I actually still haven't drawn the actual lesson. I will do that at the end of these three stories. This is the second of three stories. Okay? But he says, or look at this as your next example. As if to say, the one I just told you before was an example. Even though I didn't tell you it's an example, it was in fact an example. That's what the word awka is doing here. Aw, making it ma'tuf on it. And then the ka, meaning that was an example, and this is the second tamthil. Now, he passes by a town, and everything, you know, وَهِيَ خَاوِيَةٌ عَلَىٰ عُرُوشِهَا. It's turned over on its roofs. خَاوِيَةٌ الْفَارِغَ مِنَ السُّكَّانِ وَالْبِنَىٰ. Empty. Nobody lives there. And عَلَىٰ عُرُوشِهَا has an interesting addition to the phrase. عَرْش in the Arabic language, السَّقَف. It's the roof. Okay? Now, you imagine, sometimes when you were in Sunday school, or when you were little, you heard stories, Allah, sometimes He destroyed a town, and He turned them upside down. You ever heard this before? And what did you imagine? You imagine like a pancake or paratha type situation where buildings were picked up and then flipped over and then brought back down. Right? That's what you imagined. That's actually not what the phrasing of the Quran is. Khawiyatun ala urushiha suggests, you know, sometimes the town was destroyed by earthquake. Sometimes it was destroyed by fire from the sky. Sometimes it was by a flood. Sometimes it was, in this case particularly, it was by the hands of raiders who came and destroyed the town, killed people, and took many slaves. That's what happened. And a town was destroyed. When a town is destroyed, then nobody's there to maintain the buildings. Isn't that true? So those buildings are standing there with nobody to upkeep them, nobody to maintain them. And over time, you know, the roof, which is the most exposed part of a building, starts gathering water, starts getting, you know, termites, starts getting rusty, whatever it may be. The wood starts dilapidating, and nobody's taking care of it. And eventually, one wind comes one day, or one rainstorm comes, and what happens to that roof? It collapses. Now what you have left are whatever's left of the four walls. But those four walls were being held because of the pressure on the roof. Now there's no longer a roof, it's in the middle. And over time, these walls also start shifting and deteriorating, and eventually, a long time passes by, and these walls also tip over, and what? They fall. But what have they fallen on? On the roof. So now to describe that these towns were made desolate, and decades upon decades upon decades, maybe centuries went by, until even the walls that were remained standing, fell on top of the roofs, is captured in one brief phrase, خَاوِيَةٌ عَلَىٰ عُرُوشِهَا. Not only has this town been dead, it's been dead for a long time. And when you see a town that's been dead for that long a time, like imagine somebody goes to like the pyramids today, or some ancient ruins, Mayan ruins or something, and says, this civilization is never coming back. That's the statement this prophet is making. He's passing by and he sees this, they're done. أَنَّا يُحْيِي هَذِهِ اللَّهُ بَعْدَ مَوْتِهَا is actually him saying, how in the world is Allah going to bring this back to life? It's a very pointed statement because he's thinking, these people, this ummah, that was supposed to be the custodian of Islam, and Jerusalem was supposed to be its capital, it's supposed to be the haram, they've lost their religion so much, and this has gone for so long. There's no way this ummah could come back from this kind of death. It must be Allah will bring a new nation or something, but these people are beyond hope. They are beyond hope. And you have to understand something else. When these people, these were the Muslims of that time. When they were taken slaves in Babylonia, the Babylonians were pagan people. They had a lot of different mythologies. They had a lot of weird, like, they were into sorcery and like black magic and all this kind of stuff. And the Muslims of that time, when they lived among them, they integrated with them, and they learned a lot of those practices, and they lost a lot of their religious teachings. Actually, it's argued that the Torah, which is the book revealed to Musa alayhi salam, was actually lost from memory entirely. It was gone. There was no Torah left. Okay? For even a couple of centuries. Imagine there's no Quran in Muslim families for a couple of centuries. What Islam would be left? Can you imagine? And the capital of Islam is gone. It's done. Nobody's made salah for a few generations now, you know. If they're that far gone and that assimilated into a different religion, and you kind of see them practicing, you know, even now the Jewish, you'll see actually Hasidic Jews in Brooklyn, if you go to Brooklyn, right? And they're dressed a certain way. A lot, that's not, Musa alayhi salam didn't wear no black suit, man. I didn't have no dreidel or nothing. Where do you think that came from? That's Hellenistic culture. They were owned and lived under a dominant culture, and they adopted a lot of their practices. As a matter of fact, if you've ever been to like a, not that you have, but if you were to go to a bar mitzvah or one of those Jewish festival things and they recite the Torah, okay, melodiously, actually the recitation of the Torah had completely been lost. That was revived under European Muslim rule. They came and learned their letters and their pronunciations inspired by the Arabic language, and the science of Tajweed actually restored Jewish recitation and ritual recitation. Otherwise it was gone actually from Jewish civilization. So a really interesting, fascinating history. What I'm trying to get at is they were a lost cause. And the reason I'm emphasizing that so much is today you can say the Muslims are so deteriorated, we're a lost cause. How is it like? I mean, come on, look at our situation. Things don't get better, they only get worse. Look at the next generation of Muslims. Look at how things are in Egypt. Look at how things are in Syria. Look at how things are in Pakistan or Bangladesh or anywhere else. If we're not being killed or bombed or destroyed physically, we're socially being destroyed, culturally being destroyed, ideologically being destroyed, intellectually being destroyed, economically being, I mean, we're wrecked in every sense. There's no comeback from this. Come on. Our time is over. That's the point that's being made here. And this is actually going back to something Allah already said. أَلَمْ تَرَ إِلَى الَّذِينَ خَرَجُوا مِنْ دِيَارِهِمْ وَهُمْ أُلُوفٌ حَذَرَ الْمَوْتِ فَقَالَ لَهُمُ اللَّهُ مُوتُوا ثُمَّ أَحْيَاهُمْ. Didn't you look to those who had left their homes as refugees in the thousands, fleeing for their lives, fearing death? And Allah said to them, die, and He brought them back to life. An entire nation was brought back to life. And here, He looks at this town, sees no sign of civilization for many generations. You can't even go to this next generation and say, remember your parents? Like, we don't remember them practicing anything. Or their parents, or their parents, or their parents. Like, 4 or 5 generations ago, things were good. That's far gone from our history, far gone from our consciousness. What are you going to tell some Pakistani kid who's about to go drink with his friends at a club in Lahore, which happens now, which is common now? You tell him that your great-grandfather almost died and was killed and tortured and beat because he said, La ilaha illallah. And he just prayed one day his kids would be Muslim. And he was willing to take those beatings and be cut and be burnt for that. That's your grandfather or that's your great-grandfather. What do they know? What do they know? Now today, whether you're on this side of the Indian border or that side of the Indian border, a club is a club. Whether it's full of Hindus or Sikhs on this side or Muslims on the other side, it don't matter. It's just a party on the weekend. You know, that sense of identity, that history is gone. They're dead. And when you feel like that, then you appreciate the frustration of أَنَّا يُحْيِي هَذِهِ اللَّهُ بَعْدَ مَوْتِهِ. How is this going to come back? He's not questioning Allah's power to revive. This is an expression of the deterioration of an ummah. The deterioration of a believing people. فَأَمَاتَهُ اللَّهُ مِئَةَ عَامٍ. Then Allah gave him death for 100 years. Brought him back to life. Then when He brought him back to life, notice that the food wasn't deteriorated, but the mule was. Right? The mule deteriorated, the food didn't deteriorate. What is he learning? He's learning Allah controls and Allah decides what gets to live and what gets to die. And your projections and your calculations, your science, your expertise, you know, your predictions, none of them matter. None of them matter. There are going to be all these experts that are going to say, well, Islam, given the way statistics are going, is going to go this way or that way or the other way. Pretty soon, some of the Muslim countries that are Muslim countries right now are going to become majority atheist nations, etc. There are sociologists who will make these kinds of predictions. This Islam will die here, it might survive here. Allah Azza wa Jalla describes, when I want something to die, it will die. And when I want something to stay alive throughout the ages, it will stay alive. And if I want something that has been dead to come back to life, I will bring it back to life too. And so He brings the mule back to life in front of Him. And then He says, after the food and the mule or the donkey, He says to him, وَلِنَجْعَلَكَ آيَةً لِلنَّاسِ. Actually, before He even talks about the bones, look at the order. He says, food, drink, لَمْ يَتَسَنَّ. Meaning that, you know, the effect of the years hasn't impacted them. Now look at your mule, but before I tell you what I'm gonna do with your mule, I wanna make you a sign for the people. I wanna turn you into a sign for the people. And then He says, وَانْظُرْ إِلَى الْعِظَامِ, which is interesting. Look at the bones. He doesn't say, وَانْظُرْ إِلَى عِظَامِهِ. He says, إِلَى الْعِظَامِ. Look at the bones. Not its bones. If you say its bones, whose bones is it? The mule's bones. But if you study the biblical account, interestingly enough, the book of, you know, Jeremiah, what you find is, he called it the Valley of Bones. When he went to Jerusalem, and he saw these dilapidated buildings, he just described corpses that weren't even dead people that weren't even buried. And all you see is what everywhere? Bones. And Allah says, not just about the mule, but the entire city, the entire nation, look at the bones and see how I'm going to bring them back to life. وَانْظُرْ إِلَى الْعِظَامِ كَيْفَ نُنْشِزُهَا ثُمَّ نَكْسُوهَا لَحْمًا. It's a powerful statement. And what a way to capture, go far beyond. By the way, in the Jewish account, there's no mention of a mule. And now there's two ways of interpreting it. Perhaps the mule wasn't raised. Maybe the rest of them were raised. And the mule was dead. Maybe that was the case. Or maybe the mule was raised and with him, figuratively, maybe the rest of the nation was raised. فَلَمَّا تَبَيَّنَ لَهُ when it had been made abundantly clear to him, قَالَ أَعْلَمُ أَنَّ اللَّهَ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٍ. He said, I know Allah is completely capable over everything. The Jewish account says, the history says, that this prophet, when he learned this lesson, he went back to Babylon to the imprisoned and enslaved and culturally dominated Muslims of that time, the Israelites. And he started reviving the Torah to them, teaching them the Torah again, restored their relationship with their book. The خُذُوْمَا أَتَيْنَاكُمْ بِقُوَّةٍ. Hold on to what we've given you with great might. And as a result, they actually became a strengthened nation once again, and eventually fought off for their freedom and restored Jerusalem. That's actually and all of that began with him knowing Allah gives life back. If Allah can give life back to a person, and Allah can preserve a person, Allah can revive an entire nation. There's a reason Allah is telling us this. It's not just interesting Jewish history. There will be times in this ummah where we're gonna feel it's over. There's nothing more to do. Now just sit back and let the day of judgment come and take its toll. Now just worry about yourself. Next time you hear, إِنَّ اللَّهَ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٍ, Allah is completely capable over all things. Understand that the context in which it was said here is the context of reviving an ummah, reviving a nation, restoring their connection with God again. SubhanAllah. And Allah is capable of doing it no matter how bleak the situation looks. No matter how dead the situation looks. Okay, so this is this second story. I owe you a break, but I'll break one mystery for you. Go back and you'll notice something. It's really cool. Allah talked about fighting in the path of Allah. Fighting in the path of Allah means you have to put your life on the line, isn't it? As soon as he talked about fighting in the path of Allah, he talked about having hope in the story of Talut and Jalut. Right after that, he gave us Ayatul Kursi. Ayatul Kursi describes that Allah is the owner of all life. Allahu la ilaha illa huwa al-hay. Do you see a connection? You're going to be willing to fight for Allah's path and clean up the city of Mecca because the one that you're fighting for controls your life. He's al-hayyul qayyum. He's your protector. Allahu waliyul ladina amanu. He's the one who's going to keep bringing you out of darknesses into light. Again, life. Then the next story that was mentioned before this one is Ibrahim alayhi salam stands in front of a king who should be killing him, saying to him openly, my master is the one who gives what? Life. And he's the one who gives death. My enemy won't give me death. Allah gives life and death. And then another story, and in the story again, this man looks at a dead city and says, how will Allah bring this to what? Life. Life, 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 life. And by the way, even before all of this, didn't you look at the Israelites? They were in the thousands. Fearing death, Allah said die and then brought them back to life. Haya, haya, haya. This is a running theme. Building on one theme throughout these ayat. And the next story that's coming that I'll share with you after the break is actually also about that. That's my favorite one. That's the one where Ibrahim alayhi salam turns to Allah and says, how do you do it? How do you do it? It's such an epic question. And it bothered the Mufassirun so much. Like, why did he ask that question? Even Allah asked him, أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ? What do you not believe? Don't you believe? Didn't you believe? Why would you ask that? You know? And we're baffled by it too. So that's going to require some contemplation. You have to really think about what profound lesson lies inside. كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ. But we'll get to that inshallah after the break. بارك الله لي ولكم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.